Accession number 9752, reel 12.
Colonel Dillon, reel 12. After the Battle of Cambrai, the first day of the Battle of Cambrai, you said you returned to your headquarters to try and catch some rest. What do you remember next? What was the next thing you remember?
I remember waking up the noise, considerable noise of transport and so forth on the road outside, and there were guns and nimbers and men carrying breech blocks of 18-pounders in their hands, and it's pretty obvious that there's a major scale retreat going on. And so I wasn't immediately concerned with what was happening in the way of getting the tanks prepared to move again, because they had all been brought in, or partly brought in, and most of them in a state of disrepair, and in fact some are actually on trucks awaiting a movement back to the rear areas. Then we discovered that the Germans had broken through, and a certain number of disconsolate looking infantry came through our camp, and we got orders to make ready all tanks that could be got ready as quickly as possible. And everybody got busy doing that. And we were hard at it all day. I presume somebody held up the Germans, because we were at it all day. And in the evening, a scratch force was gathered together and Colonel Boyd Rochford, who in private life was the Queen's trainer, and he got together a number of people and found out how many tanks were runnable, and I was sent off as a guide to direct them up to lying in point where they could begin a counterattack the next day. I wasn't feeling awfully good at that time. I had my arm in a sling and I was full of all sorts of dopes. However, I managed to lead these rather fed up tank commanders with their tanks up to kicking off point and left them there. They didn't do much good. I don't think they were called upon to fight. I think the Guards Brigade mercifully turned up all in perfect order and went into the line just as if they were going on parade and held the Germans, and everybody else withdrew. And I think we were pushed back something like towards our original positions.
How did you feel about this in the tank corps? Because there you are, you'd apparently won this victory, and now it was all back to...
Well, because everybody was absolutely furious that the road was open and no cavalry appeared. As the cavalry corps, which is a very considerable number of troops, should have been there, and they should push right through. In actual fact, I just wonder whether it wasn't as well that they didn't get through, because there weren't the troops available behind them to continue the thing into a major battle, which it would have become. And really, it's typical of Haig. First of all, he didn't want to use the tanks, so he said they were no good. Then he used them as we wanted to, in a half-hearted way. He didn't support them. So You see, it was neither one thing nor the other. It was neither a raid properly organized or a withdrawal to follow, nor is it a breakthrough battle, because the troops went there to break through. And so the whole thing became a fiasco. The only thing it did do, of course, it was to demonstrate once and for all that that was the way the closing battle of the war should be fought. But mind you, the whole of that mile, I think the front was, it was something enormous, 3 to 5 miles, I think. It wasn't just an attack on a few hundred yards front. It was a wide front. And I think there were only, on the first day, only 15 casualties. When you compare that with the first day of the Somme, and I think there were 20,000 killed alone. It shows a considerable difference in the conduct of warfare. I'd like to put in here, in case I've omitted it in any other narratives, that the attack was led in the centre by our general, tank general, Brigadier General Hugh Ellis, later Sir Hugh Ellis, in person, in one of the tanks of H Battalion. He didn't go through the rest of the end of the battle in it, but he took part in the in the attack up to the furthest objective which he had been set to get to. So it was a rather gallant show, and it shows the spirit of the regiment that they were determined to do something which they'd been from which they'd been frustrated so much in the past.
They said the tank commanders were fed up as they were going back with you. They were fed up because of these factors you've just run through, were they? That was what was making them fed up.
Yes, they were fed up. They hadn't been supported. They said, there is your gap and you haven't taken it. And it caused a lot of ill feeling, which exists to this very day, tanks versus cavalry.
So what happened to you next? You'd taken these people up to the line and the guards had come in and the front was stabilising. What happened to you next?
I merely hung about doing odd duties and getting my sum back into circulation, helping where I could to get tanks onto the trucks and get them away back.
What sort of... were you still having trouble with your sum, was it?
Oh, it's very badly shattered. You can see now there's a nasty scar all down that side. The bullet actually split my thumb in two. You wouldn't believe that it could have grown like that as it is now. It was an absolute mess. But it was tied around and dressing station, local dressing station, dressed it for me. And apart from being rather larger than the other thumb, it's exactly as good as new. It's an absolute miracle.
So once you got the tanks back onto the train, where did you go?
We were taken back again to Wylie, to the best of my knowledge, where we offloaded and went on to the usual chores of refitting and getting ready for the next battle.
Had your company lost any tanks in the battle?
Not many. Mainly due to breakdown. I think one or two couldn't be got back because they'd broken down and the German counterattack captured them. You just remember that those really primitive machines, the life of a track was only about 12 miles. Then you had to change, put another set of tracks on. And a set of tracks weighed about 3 tons in all, so it was no small matter and took a long time. So we were constantly doing these heavy jobs of repair and replacement.
What would your job be as company reconnaissance officer during these periods of reorganisation and refitting, such as this one at Whaley? What did you actually do? Because you didn't have a tank of your own.
No, to be absolutely frank, I had very little to do. Other than act as a link boy between the company and the battalion headquarters, which are now known as liaison officers. Very little. Scout round the country on my motorbike picking up black market food such as eggs and so forth from the mess.
So how was the mess organised?
We had company messes. One had a basket, had a picnic basket which was equipped with the ordinary tools of eating, plates and cooking stuff and so on. So when you got a chance, you put up a little shelter of some sort and got a fire going, and you were able to have a cooked meal. Apart from that, you didn't have a mess at all. I went on the move, hit where you, what you could and where you could.
What about recreations while you were at Whaley?
Oh yes, all the usual games, football games, and when the weather was decent, we'd get down to swim in the local canal. For some unknown reason, we were provided with a certain number of horses, so that I just could borrow a horse and go off exploring with that. The most terrible creatures they were. I never rode such stuff again in my life before. During the war, the purchasing officers bought anything they could. I remember one was a racehorse. Another one would only turn one way. It wouldn't turn to the right at all. If you wanted to go to the left, you had to go right around and start again. Another one used to rear up on his hind legs if it saw a lorry. There weren't many lorries, fortunately. Very unpleasant feeling. However, very good for me. It taught me quite a bit about horse riding that I didn't know before.
Would you go to local estaminets in the French villages or restaurants in the local villages?
Oh yes, go into those. The supplies are naturally restricted the nearer you got to the fighting area. You could nearly always get beer, but any spirits were very hard to get by because they had been forbidden by the French government. You could get champagne and wine and very thin beer, and if you got to know the estaminet and a little bit away from the front, you could pick up things like liqueurs and French brandy and so on. But food was very difficult because the population was rationed, you see, itself.
Was there much drinking amongst the officers of your battalion and company?
Yes. It was particularly out of the line. It was the one relief left, people whose nerves were on the end of endurance. And there was plenty of rum. Theoretically, there was a rum issue each day, but there was always more over and above what was allotted for you, because the casualties didn't drink their rum, and so it piled up. And the supplies from the Army Navy stores and Nappy were very good, whiskey and gin and stuff. There's no shortage of that, I'm glad to say. There weren't what you might call drunken revels. We used to play ventillon and sort of strip poker, that sort of thing. Sometimes in the evenings, people mostly generally went to bed with a good deal of something in their stomachs to go. In the sense of uproarious drinking and fighting, no, there wasn't any.
Did any of the officers become dependent on alcohol, what we call now alcoholics, I suppose, or temporarily dependent on alcohol?
I knew one or two cases. Sadly enough, one or two cases, very young chaps, 22, 3, something like that, who simply depended on it. The odd thing was, it didn't make them drunk at all and staggering about or anything like that, but it simply killed the nerve which causes fear. You see, after every man has got a certain fill of courage, a certain quantity. It varies tremendously. And when you've used up that amount of courage, you've got to replace it with something else. And of course, army discipline and training lends you the ability to carry on to some extent, and drink does the rest, hides the rest.
Did you use drink in that way? Or what was your own morale like?
My own morale was good enough to keep me going. I didn't like it very much towards the end of the war. I was getting worn down. I'd twice been wounded and I was beginning to run out of my supplies of courage. But I managed to get through to the end.
So you didn't resort to heavy drinking?
I didn't resort to heavy drinking, no. I find that I always carried some whiskey about in my water flask, but more as a reviver than anything. I didn't feel I needed it to keep me going. Talking about this question of courage, I don't know whether I mentioned this before, but one day we were going forward on an attack of some sort, I forget whether some or somewhere, and I came across a major who was sitting on a pile of sandbags and looking away from the front. He looked perfectly all right. I said, "Are you hurt, sir?" He said, "There's nothing matter with me." He said, "I can't move. I just simply can't move." He'd come to the end of his resources and he couldn't walk. He was not frightened, wasn't yelling or trying to run away, but he was just stuck, and he had to be carried away on a stretcher. I suppose he came to, and they got him in hospital. It was what used to be called shell shock. In other words, it was battle fatigue. And once you reached a certain stage, you run out of supplies, and there are no more. A drink will supply to a certain extent, but then that runs out.
Did any officers drink so much that it affected their capabilities as officers? In other words, impaired their competence?
No, I didn't see any cases of that. I don't think so. I've seen one or two chaps in battle being rather over-hearty and over-brave and realising that they'd had a good belly full of rum or something like that, and to the troops too, but not adversely, rather the other way, making them more fearless than they would have been.
You mentioned that they played Vingt-et-un and a couple of other games, strip poker or whatever.
Oh, whatever, yeah.
Was there much gambling as opposed to just card playing or amongst the officers?
We hadn't got no money to play for high stakes. No, it was only penny stuff that we played. The usual card games that one plays while away the time. And if you've lost five francs in a night, equivalent then to about 4 or 5 bob, it was a bad night. We've got to take the next night. It was pretty innocent. I don't know any high play going on. Maybe done further back amongst the generals in their chateaus, but I don't think so. Somehow there's too much to do for them.
Had you built up a sense of pride in your unit or had the heavy machine gun corps, tank corps, whichever it was by then, had they developed a pride in themselves as a unit, a sort of regimental pride or battalion pride?
I know what you mean. I would say yes, to as much extent as could be possible, remembering that these tank units were built up with all sorts of odds and ends of people from every regiment in the army, and some who were brought out from civil life and shoved into uniforms. I mean, people like mechanical experts, engineers and so on, and you've got a sense of loyalty to your unit. And of course, oddly enough, what brought a sense of togetherness, regimental spirit, more than anything, was the frightful way in which Haig had behaved in doing everything he could to damage and break up the tank regiments.
Did you think that at the time, or is that in hindsight?
No.
I mean, the Haig part.
I don't know that we specifically pegged it down on Haig himself, but on General Headquarters as a whole, and the pig-headed people who were running it. There was a very strong feeling that ran through all the tank units. We felt that we've produced great effort in a very short time, a world beater, and it's been frittered away and mucked about by people who don't know anything about it and don't want to.
Did you feel yourself an elite within the army? You know, did you feel you were... Did you have that sort of elite pride?
You mean like the... people like the Household Cavalry or something? No, because we had no background at all. You see, proud enough of what we were doing, but we had no background or flag to rally around.
What happened after your period at Whaley?
We were moved up to the near the front line in small parties. There was one complete company was stationed at Elbert, which was really close to the line, and we had other sections of four tanks dotted about in various concealed positions close to the line, within half a mile in some cases. And part of my job to go around and visit these detachments, which is fairly exciting work because the approaches, naturally enough, are on the roads and they're all overlooked by the Germans.
What was the purpose of this policy?
The idea was that when the Germans arrived, the tanks should start out and, as somebody described it, should emerge like savage rabbits and go to the Germans. You see, they had absolutely no conception of using these valuable fighting machines to lead a coherent force in a counterattack, which they should have done.
Who had developed this policy? Was this part of Ellis's?
No.
The senior, or was this imposed?
Imposed on us. That's why we were so, that's why we were so savage. That thing was simply ridiculous. It is proved by the fact that when the German attack in March 19 came, and our battalion was stuck within a few hundred yards of the front line, and the first thing that we knew about it was that the troops, the crews, were trying to start up their tanks while others were holding off the Germans to enable them to do so. having got his battalion together, my commanding officer, who was a brave and very good soldier, got his battalion back and so to speak in hand, and he's able to deliver a counterattack entirely unsupported by any troops or guns of any sort, which he did, and which had a devastating effect on the Germans, because it held up their advance by at least 24 hours, but it decimated the battalion.
So let me just get this straight. Your battalion was spread out, actually, with the exception of the company in Alba, in these savage rabbit formations, shall we call them. But when the German attack came, they were caught unawares, so to speak.
Yes.
So they pulled back and reformed.
Yes.
How did the orders to do that get through? Or was this just something that had been pre-arranged unofficially or officially?
It was done by me, mostly, on my motorbike. I'd go, the other company reconnaissance officers go up to these outlying sections and give them their orders. And the next...
What do you remember about that, the first days of that attack? What was the German bombardment like, for instance?
Well, it was very heavy, it was very nasty, because true to the tenets of idiocy which obtained amongst the higher command, our camp was situated on a crossroads, of all places, with Nissen huts on each side. And so, of course, it's an obvious target for an enemy bombardment. My feelings there were to get my bedding roll on the back of the motorbike and get ready for anything. And I sent off to collect these detached sections, get them all together. It wasn't easy, but we constantly had breakdowns and unfortunately people trying to mend the tank with the feeling that the Germans were breathing down their necks. Not very nice. But the Australians and the Canadians, who were not war weary, came in about then. Actually, the Germans had run out of steam because they found great difficulty in supplying their troops across the Elbe to some battlefields which were a wreck, and they ran out of ammunition and petrol and everything and had to stop. And when they did, the Australians and Canadians took over the line, and they held it all right while we legged it back to recover and refit. See, there's another instance of using a vital attacking arm in a defensive role for which it was never suited and was quite useless.
What did you do in the counterattack? You say that once you got them all together, the battalion put in a counterattack during which it was decimated or largely destroyed. What do you remember of that counterattack? How was it organised and what happened?
Well, the orders were given for the tanks to advance on a certain frontage from where they were, in a certain direction, on a certain frontage, which I was able to lay down for them. And we knew where the Germans were, and it's a pivotal place, but it was actually the small town of Bapaume, and they were making for this vital communication centre where the roads all met, and we crashed into the middle of them there.
How many tanks had you got together for this attack?
Well, there was the whole battalion. There would be, well, in full strength, there would be 36, probably weren't so many as that, but something like that.
What did you do during the actual tank? Follow on foot? Or during the actual attack?
No, I was sitting with my colonel on the roadside, watching it from just the flank, on the flank side. We had a lovely view of a tank battle. Of course, it was extremely unpleasant because the Germans were shelling that particular road with long-range artillery, sort of 10 and 12 inch stuff was coming down, and any quantity of it. And it was very, very nasty indeed. We had some sort of a scrape or shell hole on the side of the road we got into. But it certainly stopped the Germans and turned them back, and we were able to withdraw gracefully.
What could you see of the attack? You say you had a good view of it.
Well, you could see as much as you can see of any attack, because the amount of smoke and dust is so great. But you could actually see tanks in action shooting at Germans, and you could see Germans trying to support the tanks and being shot down by the following echelons as they came along.